You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. BYU Radio invites you to join with us and other listeners in 10,000 acts of service over the next 30 days. That's our goal, and you can join the effort by performing some sort of service, large or small. For great ideas, we encourage you to go to justserve.org. That's an online resource where you can discover volunteer opportunities right in your own zip code. Once again, justserve.org. She is depicted as a lioness, and that fits very well with her role as a warrior goddess. But another side of her personality is a bit more tame than all of that, because she's also a goddess of healing. I'm talking about the Egyptian deity Sekhmet, sometimes called the daughter of Ra, the sun god. You've heard of Ra. And I can only imagine that to have lived in ancient times as a priestess of Sekhmet, well, that would have been a place of considerable honor or some special status in society. What do I know? I'm making it up. I'm not the expert. Well, our next story is actually about just such a woman, a priestess of Sekhmet, who lived during the late period of ancient Egypt. That's all to say this is long before Cleopatra. That might be a toehold for us. Let's say, actually, that she lived 400 or 500 years before the life of Jesus Christ. So the story of this Egyptian priestess to Sekhmet is very old if you want to talk about her life. But there's a modern twist to the tale you're about to hear if you want to talk about her afterlife, which is to say the story of the disposition of her mortal remains. Where did they go? The modern twist is until fairly recently, nobody knew a thing about her. And her discovery in 2016 was both a shock and a delight, all wrapped in one. Wrapped is the right word to use in a story about a mummy. We have with us now Dr. Jamie Fraser, curator for the Ancient Levant and Anatolia at the British Museum in London. He has been involved in archaeological projects in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Kashmir, Greece. I could go on and on. Cambodia, Australia, Jordan. He gets around. You get the picture. Jamie Fraser on the line with us. Jamie, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Hi, Marcus.
You know, I haven't even said the name of this priestess yet. And Merneithetis? Will that work?
Well done, Merneithetis. You nailed it. Although ancient Egyptians didn't write down the vowels between the words, so your guess could be as good as mine on the pronunciation front.
Well, in full disclosure, I asked you to coach me a little, and so Merneithetis it is, based on what you say. I want to talk about this living priestess before we get to talking about the dead priestess, the mummy part. Can we talk about her life and what we might be able to surmise about that?
Sure. So this coffin for this lady, Merneithetis, stylistically, the way the coffin looks, the way it's been decorated, the types of texts that are written on it, that dates to about 600 BC, give or take, a period called the 26th Dynasty. And we know from the texts on that coffin that the lady, Merneithetis, worked as probably a priestess or a worshipper in the temple of Sekhmet, probably around a place called Sais, near Cairo, modern-day Cairo. But when we say priestess or priest or things like that, it's somewhat different to how you would imagine a priest or a priest to be operating today, someone who's, you know, turns up to the church every day, takes holy vows, all that sort of thing. Back in ancient Egypt, you could be associated with these temples by virtue of being born into the right station. And Merneithetis was probably a wealthy woman. We know this from the status of her coffin. And by virtue of being a wealthy woman, she probably had a position that served as priestess in the temple to Sekhmet. But that didn't mean that that's all she did. She would have lived at home. She would have raised a family. We know that she had at least one son because he's also named on her coffin. And she would have had a private life rubbing right up against that religious life as well.
So it sounds to me like the story of her life is something that has been gleaned most particularly from writings on this coffin or sarcophagus or whatever it is.
Yeah, if we didn't have her sarcophagus or her coffin, Egyptology 101, if it's made of wood, we tend to say coffin, and if it's made of stone, we say sarcophagus. So this coffin's made of cedar wood, cedar from Lebanon, so we should call it a coffin, although I slip into saying sarcophagus like everybody else. But this coffin is the only evidence we had that she ever existed. And I guess that's why she was buried in such a way, so that she would be remembered forever for the afterlife. But if she hadn't had this coffin, we wouldn't know that she ever walked the face of this earth.
So, you know, when you have so little to go on, it's still kind of exciting, isn't it, to think she had a child, she had a function, she had money.
Marcus, it's exhilarating because it's exactly like it's detective work. So we've got this one coffin in a museum that I was working at back in Sydney in Australia, and this coffin, every colour, every pigment, every decoration, the materiality of it, the types of wood that have been used, the way it's been shaped, the texts that have been written onto it, the way the body's been treated, every one of those things represents a decision that's been made in the ancient past. And by activating those decisions, by working out why something looks like it does, we can learn a lot about Manetha Teston and about her life if we ask the right questions in the right way. And the first one, as you say, is that she had a lot of money, because back in ancient Egypt, if you got mummified, automatically we can assume that you were pretty well off, because the process of mummification was very long and very expensive, and you had to come from a very wealthy family or work for a very wealthy institution in order to be mummified.
Now, what can be gleaned from a comparative kind of analysis where you're saying, well, this coffin is like others that have been found over the course of modern archaeology?
So one of the big problems with studying things from ancient Egypt is that so many of them have been dug up and looted by tomb robbers, usually in the 19th or early 20th century, and that's how museums have come to have them in their collection. And this museum back in Sydney is no different. It acquired this coffin by a donation made in 1850. So we don't know where that coffin is from. I mean, stylistically, okay, it's from Egypt, but is it from Alexandria or Cairo or Abydos or Thebes? Because we don't have the context, the place that an archaeologist dug it up, we've lost all this information. What was she buried with? Who was she buried with? What images did her family choose to paint on her tomb's wall? We don't have any of that. But the coffin itself becomes our primary lens by which we can start to get back a lot of that information. And you're absolutely right by saying we have to compare it. So we compare the shape, the style, the colours, all the look of this coffin, the flavour, to coffins that we have excavated across the last couple of hundred years in Egypt. And from all of that, we can say pretty confidently, yeah, this coffin dates to the 26th dynasty, so about 600 BC, give or take. And it's almost certainly from this place called Sais near Cairo, which is a particular kind of place for this particular kind of coffin. And then we can start to narrow down her life from there.
Now, the story that I kind of received, kind of the conventional wisdom, and I'm talking about going all the way back to elementary school, is the kind of the notion that you got this guy named Napoleon, and he starts going to Egypt, and then it becomes a fad, and everybody from Europe starts going to Egypt, and they're pilfering and looting and bringing stuff back, sometimes just because it's kind of cool, but also in the name of science, I guess.
Yeah, oh, I think your elementary school did you proud. That's absolutely kind of the rough guide to Egyptology and how it all begins. It really does kind of hit Western consciousness when Napoleon, you know, in the campaign in Egypt and the Battle of the Nile, starts to bring back Egyptological stuff back to Europe. Egyptomania kicks off, and of course, you know, 100 years later, there's the discovery of Tutankhamun, and you know, all bets are off. Everyone loves Egypt, as we still do. But you are absolutely right, because not everyone is just looting to find pretty stuff. There's a lot of people out there trying to ask questions about who these people were, and very scientific questions for their time. One of those people, and this is the link to the coffin of this lady Manetha Tess, was a guy called Sir Charles Nicholson. And he's the guy that founded a museum at the University of Sydney in 1850. And he decided to go out to Egypt and to start collecting objects, not because they looked nice, but because he was collecting an assemblage, a group of objects that could tell the whole story of Egyptian civilization. So he very carefully got different sorts of objects from different sites, from different periods, so that he could bring it back to Australia donate it to this university, the University of Sydney, to start a museum, but to start it as a teaching collection for students. It's one of the earliest university museums in the world. And we're very lucky that he did that, because if he hadn't, then the coffin of Menethetes and her contents may never have survived.
So I understand the year was 1856 when he makes his way to the Nile. And can you kind of describe what we might suspect to have been kind of the marketplace for mummies? I get the gist that mummies were everywhere in Egypt. Like we're talking thousands, and even today there are digs where they're turning up more and more mummies.
Yeah, my apologies. I was getting my dates confused. He sets the university up in 1850 and then makes these donations in 1860. So in 1856, 57, that's the time he's out in Egypt collecting everything. And you're right. There is mummy overload, because the amount of tourists coming to Egypt doing what was called the Grand Tour, doing a sort of set itinerary. This is the time of Baedeker and early Thomas Cook travel programs. Everyone who can afford it from North America, from Europe, from Australia is out there, and they all want to return with Egyptica. I mean, one French clergyman remarked to the head of the Egyptian government at the time, it would be remiss of him not to return to Egypt with a crocodile in one hand and a mummy in the other. And we know from Charles Nicholson's account that as he is sailing down the Nile in his boat, collecting all the various artifacts that he would eventually donate to the university, he's very careful in the mummies that he does select and the coffins that he selects, because he is spoilt for choice. And he actually writes that at one point he went left for dinner. When he returned after dinner to the boat, some sellers had placed 20, 25 mummies all on the deck of the boat. He didn't want them all. He said, take them away, take them away. And they left a couple of the really bad ones that they didn't want, which he eventually had to just put on the shore and leave. So there are more mummies out there than the tourists could know what to do with.
Well, the reason I ask this question is because it seems to me that if there's going to be a coffin for this priestess, Menethetes, and if that coffin's going to make its way all the way from Egypt to Australia, and if Sir Charles Nicholson has a hand in this, doesn't matter if it's him or somebody else, it just seems to me that with just this, you called it mummy overload, with all these mummies everywhere, that kind of explains how this particular coffin could be kind of set aside, not quite forgotten, but never opened for 150 years.
Well, this is the billion-dollar question, isn't it? So we opened this coffin in 2016, and to our astonishment, and I'll never forget this, discovered that it had an array of contents inside, not a complete mummy, but a mummy that had been cut up by tomb robbers, ransacking it, looking for gold, for jewels, for amulets, and finding them. But what they left behind was the remains of a human, of a person, of probably Menethetes herself. But imagine cutting up a mummy, then shaking a coffin up around like a cocktail shaker, and all the bits and pieces all mixed up, and a complete kind of melange of stuff. It was quite extraordinary. But in 1870, give or take, the first catalogue of the Nicholson Museum was published, and there was a line in that where they said that the coffin of Menethetes was empty. And I think that phrase, was empty, becomes received wisdom. And there's no need to open it if it's empty. But of course, was empty to somebody in the 1870s might mean empty of a complete mummy that's worthy of display, rather than of a sort of a mixed assemblage of bits and pieces, which may not be considered so important 100 years ago, but scientifically today are extremely important to know about.
There was nothing of interest to them in Victorian times.
Or they just got it wrong. We just don't know.
I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. It's an honor to have with us Dr. Jamie Fraser, curator for the Ancient Levant and Anatolia at the British Museum in London. We're talking about that moment in 2016 when he, I think with a few others, opened this coffin that turned out to be, as we surmise, the coffin of Menethetes, this ancient Egyptian priestess. Dr. Jamie Fraser, did you dare touch anything? I mean, I don't know how you go about opening a coffin to begin with. I don't know if you're supposed to have light that enters in, if you're supposed to. I trust that by this time, in your science. You know, you don't just rummage around stuff. You don't poke at it.
It was tempting, but no, we didn't. We opened it in a room down in the basement of this museum in the University of Sydney. And this room had been used for years as an education room for school students. And this coffin of Manethites in a Perspex case had sat in the back of the room I remember as a student at the University of Sydney studying with it just in the background. It was always there. And the reason why we opened it really was because what I wanted to do was to jack this coffin up onto some scaffolding so that we could photograph the hieroglyphics on the underside because they'd never been photographed. But to do that, we needed just to be sure that the coffin was actually empty, as this old catalogue said. And to do that, we needed to open the coffin. So we arranged to do it on one day when the schoolroom wasn't being used. And I was there and a couple of other museum staff, and particularly our collections management team. So a museum is usually split between the curators who do the research and the public engagement and the exhibitions and the collections management. And they're the guys who sort of look after the physical aspect of the objects, moving them, doing conservation, that sort of thing. So we had two collection managers with us, two ladies called Marie and Julie. And Marie and Julie lifted the coffin out of the case and onto a table. And the lid of the coffin, well, the coffin normally kind of opens up from the middle, but in antiquity, the wooden nails that fix the very front part of the coffin to the trough had been removed. So that meant that the lid of the coffin actually slid off, almost like a pencil box. And so very carefully, Marie standing away and holding it steady, and Julie at the other end very carefully pulling the lid back, centimeter by centimeter, the lid slowly was pulled all the way back to reveal the inside of the contents. And we all leaned forward. And you could have heard a pin drop. It was astonishing, because what we were expecting to see was an empty coffin. And instead, what we did see was this collection that I described before of bandages and bones all mixed around, all piled up on each other, almost to the rim of the trough in parts of it. As well as sort of what looks like coal, lumps of black hardened substance. And that's a hardened sort of bituminous resinous substance that would have got poured across the mummy when it was put into the coffin and then hardened as a preserving agent. And the tomb robbers who had destroyed the mummy had cracked through it, like cracking through the crust on a creme brulee. And then that all got mixed up into this as well. And we all just stood there in astonishment. And then an Egyptologist who was working with the curators at the museum, she suddenly exclaimed, "Look, there's a bead." And she was right. There was a small faience, sort of an early glass, bluey-green glass bead sitting on the top. And then she said, "There's another one. And there's another one." And it turned out that once we did the count, there was over 100 of these beads scattered just on the top. And what we found out much, much later was that there was actually over 8,000 of these beads mixed up with all these bandages and bones. So what we then did after taking some photographs was put the lid back on the coffin and not touch a thing, because we really needed to work out what we should do. Should we just leave her there? These are the remains of a person, after all. Who are we to disturb them? So should we leave her there? Should we do something to the remains? Should we record the remains? Should we preserve them? We didn't know at that point, and we really needed to make that decision, take it very seriously and make it very conscientiously before we judged our next move.
Is this the kind of thing where all of a sudden you realize we're going to be over budget?
Yes. At this point, I also started applying for various grants that I hadn't anticipated.
I suspected as much. Well, tell me about the Nicholson Museum as it was at the University of Sydney. I understand that it doesn't exist in that form anymore. And so the coffin, the mummy, it's all been moved elsewhere?
Yeah. So at the end of 2019, a new museum was built on the campus of the University of Sydney called the Chow Chak Wing Museum, named after its principal donor. And that combined both the antiquities collections from the Nicholson Museum, along with some Australian Indigenous collections from another campus museum and some artworks from the campus gallery into one larger museum. And so there's a bespoke mummy room in that new museum. So the Nicholson collection, including this coffin of Manethites, has been moved into there.
I want to ask you just a little bit about the fact that the remains, who knows when, were desecrated. And in a way, there's part of me that cringes to think of grave robbers that are looting for whatever precious gems or artwork they might find that they could sell. I kind of hate that story. But it's part of the story too. And I'm wondering if in your archaeological analysis, you're trying to tell that tale as well as the ancient one, the more ancient one.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think on any object or any features of human remains that we have in a museum, I mean, there's so many different stories that that as a curator you need to access and ask. And in this case, the coffin and its contents, what has happened to them since the moment they were interred in the tomb back in the 26th dynasty, right up until now, the moment that they were opened in Sydney on the other side of the world, 2,500 years later. Well, that's quite an extraordinary story as well. And so there's a whole journey there to talk about. And well, one of the reasons that this assemblage of bones and bandages is really quite important is because those sorts of things aren't kept, well, traditionally at least, haven't been kept by museums, certainly not museums in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Normally that would get chucked out or removed from the coffin in order to find objects for display or to make the coffin more presentable. But I think it goes back to Charles Nicholson collecting this coffin for study, for research, for students, that kind of kept it apart from that process. And so it preserved it. And so there are very few museums in the world who are confronted by this sort of situation simply because it doesn't really preserve much, let alone in Egypt or modern museums. And so that story of tomb robbing is a very powerful story that we can tell from these sort of desecrated remains. So one of the things we wanted to do was capture what those remains looked like before we touched a single bone or bandage or bead so that that story could be represented as well.
Since the life of Sir Charles Nicholson, a whole methodology has arisen, and it has to do with the study of genes, looking for DNA and such. Is this particular mummy, a good candidate for doing any kind of genetic inquiry?
Yeah, it's a great question. And unfortunately, the answer is not a good candidate, simply because the bones are in such poor condition, such friable condition, that the preservation of the DNA is looking not very likely. That said, we did do some proteomics, which is kind of looking at proteins that are preserved, and that got some qualified results. So I think down the line, at the moment with our technology for DNA, it's not a good candidate. There are better candidates out there for, you know, quite expensive procedures. But, you know, ask me again in 10 years or 20 years or 50 years when the technology has changed, the questions have changed, the techniques have changed. And I think the things that we can get from DNA now, we will be able to get from these sorts of bones and these sorts of badly preserved remains just in a little bit later.
You've just opened the door to my final curiosity for this conversation, which is the future of all of this, the coffin, the mummy, whatever artifacts are in that box. What is the best case scenario 10, 20, 30 years from now as to where it all should be kept, how it should be kept, for whom it should be kept, all of those future questions?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you how we have kept her now, and then I'll tell you about how we might keep her in the future. So what we did was we decided to excavate the remains because they weren't well preserved, and I don't think Manethites, out of anyone, would have wanted her, all her remains to have been mixed up like this. You know, there was no dignity in death in that coffin, not after the robbers had got to it. So we did excavate very carefully, and then we studied the remains. But then we packaged them up very, very carefully with a lot of respect, and dealing with human remains is always behaving with respect. And then very carefully, with respect, placed them back in the coffin. And although that coffin is on display in the Chow Chak Wing Museum, the lid is shut, these remains are inside it, carefully packaged away, so that at least she rests there in some kind of coherence, with some sort of dignity and some sort of respect, in the coffin where she was always supposed to go. Now, down in the future, that does mean that future scientists can access those remains to study if there are techniques or new questions to be asked, and if that can be done while still maintaining that balancing act of respecting the personhood of Menethetes and who she is. And as long as I think we're always doing these sorts of research, they're doing these sorts of inquiry with respect, then the irony that although this mummy is not very well preserved, in a way it's more accessible for scientific study because it's easier to get to the bones and to the remains than a fully wrapped mummy, which you would naturally cause destruction to access. So I think down the line, there'll be a lot more research going on with these remains from Menethetes, so long as we can always maintain her dignity and respect.
It's a wonderful story to hear from you, and thank you, Dr. Jamie Fraser, for telling us about Menethetes. It's been a pleasure to visit with you.
Pleasure speaking with you, Marcus.
Jamie Fraser, curator for the Ancient Levant and Anatolia at the British Museum. Thinking about Egypt leads to thoughts about, yes, mummies, but also pyramids and the Great Sphinx, but don't forget the obelisks. I don't know if obeliskectomy is a word, but it really should be because Egypt has suffered a number of ectomy procedures, including obeliskectomies. Where did these removed obelisks go is our next question on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Mummies are a favorite topic for a lot of people, although I have to say that the ancient process of embalming, that's a little bit unsettling. Still, this subject is one of the first things people think of when trying to imagine Egypt, ancient Egypt. Well, maybe pyramids and sphinxes come first, but mummies certainly third. There is another architectural object from antiquity, probably not as quickly remembered, but even more global than the pyramids. I'm talking about obelisks, the likes of which you can find not only in Egypt, but in Paris, London, and New York City as well. Not too long ago, I spoke with Bob Breyer, a senior research fellow at Long Island University. He's author of Cleopatra's Needles, The Lost Obelisks of Egypt. You know, when I first heard the term Cleopatra's Needle, I thought to myself, well, that's clever, that's kind of quaint, but I've since learned that's accurate. That's what the word obelisk means, something like a spit or a skewer or even a needle or a pin. And why would we be using a Greek term for this anyway?
Well, actually, when the Greeks came into Egypt, they saw these obelisks and they said, gee, that looks like our shish kebab skewers. So they called them obeliscus, which is your meat skewer.
Now, you said obeliscus, and then a moment ago you said obelisk. Do you happen to have a preference?
Well, in English, I tend to say obelisk, yeah.
Yeah. You've heard both, though. It's all
oh,
good.
Yeah. Sure, sure.
Well, these obelisks that you're talking about that are lost, you don't mean lost and gone forever, but lost to Egypt, right?
Yeah. My book is primarily about the three obelisks that left Egypt in the 19th century, but there are, of course, a lot in Rome also. But I really talk most about those three. So they're lost to Egypt, not disappeared.
And this theft, as it happens, or were they acquired fairly? Were they purchased?
No, neither, actually. It's not a theft, and they weren't purchased. They were gifts. In the 19th century, the Egyptian government was currying favor with European powers because they wanted to modernize Egypt. And the ruler, Muhammad Ali, was giving away antiquities left and right and center, and he gave away obelisks.
That's kind of strange. I don't think that practice happens very often nowadays, does it?
No, not anymore. Nothing leaves Egypt. No antiquities leave Egypt. But, you know, Muhammad Ali was actually Albanian. He wasn't an Egyptian. The the Turks were sort of controlling Egypt. And Muhammad Ali didn't view it as any kind of patrimony or anything. He was just giving them away.
Wow. Now, if you give away an obelisk, who's responsible for hauling it out? Because those are heavy things.
Shipping wasn't included, Marcus. so you had to get your own. And three big ones left in the 19th century. The first one to leave was the Paris obelisk. It left around 1832. And it wasn't easy. None of the obelisks came over easily. Each one has a tremendous story. Every one of them was fraught with adventure. Some men lost lives bringing them over. So they're all great stories.
How do you even do that? Well, you know what? Let's go back to square one. Before we transport one, let's make one, shall we?
Sure.
How do you even – when I think about Stonehenge, or if I think about you know, the Great Pyramids, I'm always just scratching my head thinking that it was possible.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that I've thought about a lot is, you know, as Egyptologists, we talk all the time about what's the most amazing thing the Egyptians ever did. You know, and there's plenty of things that come to mind, like the Great Pyramid, like you suggest, or maybe even Tutankhamun's gold mask, or maybe Karnak Temple. But for me, it's a no-brainer. It's the obelisks. They are the most remarkable productions in Egypt, I think. They're made out of a single piece of stone. They're all granite. They're all made out of the same stone. They all came from the same quarry at Aswan, the granite quarry, because it's the only stone strong enough to support its weight. Otherwise, if you tried to make a big obelisk out of, say, limestone, it would just crack. You can't have a stone that big out of limestone. So these things are really big and really hard. Granite is really hard. So when they quarried them, and you're asking how do you make one, when they quarried them, believe it or not, don't think about guys chiseling them out of the quarry. They didn't have chisels hard enough to chisel granite. They had copper, they had bronze, but that won't work on granite. So they're actually pounded out of the quarry with other stones that are slightly harder than granite. So you imagine these guys, probably prisoners, lined up along an obelisk that's sort of drawn on the bottom of the quarry face, and you're just pounding away with stones all day long.
Now, what stones in particular? I don't know where are they getting these from.
Well, they occur in Egypt also. They're called dolerite, and it's slightly harder than granite. So they use things that are about you know, sort of like a bowling ball. Imagine a bowling ball. You keep dropping it and dropping it and dropping it, and it chips away till you got your rough quarry outline. And it takes a long time. I mean, by long, we've done experiments to see how long does it take to do an obelisk. And if you're dropping this bowling ball on your granite, you go at the rate of about a quarter of an inch an hour. So every 4 hours, you get an inch.
So these things aren't chiseled out. They're kind of pummeled out.
Yeah, they're pounded out. That's right. And then to get the really fine polish, they use a kind of slurry. They use like a sandpaper made out of sand and water, and you just sand it down.
Now, as this is being taken from the quarry, I understand it's horizontal to begin with, right?
Exactly, right.
And so you have to – I'm just trying to imagine this.
Yeah,
I'm putting,
yeah.
you would go down – you'd have to make a couple of trenches on either side of the intended obelisk.
Exactly. You're envisioning it right. Now you're going to come to a problem, right, Marcus?
Yeah, I don't know how to get under it.
Yeah, how do you get under it? Well, I think the answer there, you're right. It's the hard part. It's still fixed to the bottom of the quarry. You may have an obelisk free on three sides, but you got to get that bottom part free. What they did is they tunneled under it. They had the same dolerite ball, and they're pounding only horizontally, which is much harder. And they're pounding sideways, and what they do is they form a little tunnel under the future obelisk. And then they fill that tunnel with a granite block. So it's supported on the granite block, and then you make another tunnel next to it, supported on a granite block, and eventually you get the thing resting on granite blocks. Not easy.
Yeah, and we haven't even gotten to the part. You've talked about polishing it. I don't know. I mean, that would take time, too. But then you got to get the thing moved to where it's supposed to go and upright.
Yes, that's right. And that's basically a lot of guys on ropes. They're just hauling it on rollers. You have logs, basically, and guys on ropes pulling it down to the river so they can put it on a barge so they can get it to the temple where they want to erect it. And, you know, that's the average obelisk. That's maybe an average obelisk, say, maybe weighs 250 tons, right? But there's one obelisk in the quarry still. It's called the unfinished obelisk because it wasn't completed. It cracked while they were making it, you know. And it's the largest obelisk ever attempted, and it's an order of magnitude larger than anything we've ever seen. It's 1,000 tons. It weighs about as much as two jumbo jets.
Well, is this obelisk that's lying there unfinished, it's still attached to the quarry? It never got removed?
Exactly.
And did they do any polishing on it, or is it still in its rough-hewn state?
It's not terribly rough. No. It's pretty good. You look at it and you say, oh, there's the obelisk. I mean, it's pretty clear. They've done some polishing on it, but before they could free it from the bottom, the thing cracked, and then they tried to cut it down to make it a little smaller, and it cracked again. So there were basic flaws within the stone. You know, you can just imagine the moment where one guy says to the other, no, you tell the Pharaoh.
I was going to say, that was not a good day.
No.
Oh, my. So I would imagine, though, that residual broken relic of the past, that thing is kind of the key to how they were made.
Yes, yes. We really can look at it and get an idea. Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's talk about their function, their purpose. You've already kind of gotten into transporting them by a barge, and that seems improbable to me, too. But what are they for?
Well, they always came in pairs, and they were erected in front of temples, and they're inscribed with hieroglyphs. And the hieroglyphs don't tell us anything interesting ever. What they are is the pharaoh's name. And basically, the obelisks are telling you, I, the pharaoh, Ramses the Great, built this temple that you're now entering. So you enter the temple between the two obelisks, through the doorway, and the obelisks are proclaiming who built the temple.
It's just the byline. It's the credit. Somebody's got to get credit for it.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, and so they're ornamental in function. There's nothing mysterious about them. I mean, I've heard stories over the years about, you know, their either special charms or incantations or religious function.
No, not really. They are always associated with the sun because the tips of the obelisks sort of get the rays of the sun first, but that's about it. They didn't have any mysterious function, no. They're really, like you say, kind of labels.
Well, one of the things I like about them is the tip, because there's the pyramidal shape to the tip, and that is very – I mean, if you're a designer, you got a motive, and there you go. You've got your big pyramids, and even the obelisks have got their pyramids.
Yeah, every obelisk has a little pyramid at the top. Yeah, it's kind of cool. It is.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's go back to the barge thing if we can.
Yes.
whoever thought that up was either – a genius or a fool, because, you know, the stone could sink. You've got to make quite a barge.
Yeah, it's a really big barge. And I'll tell you something that shocked me. We don't have many ancient accounts of how they did obelisks. But Queen Hatshepsut quarried two obelisks, a pair, like everybody else. And she, on her temple, put a depiction of them towing the obelisk to the temple. And it's really cool, because what she did was, you know, you say you have to make a pretty big barge. She put two obelisks end to end on one barge. Not the way I would have done it, you know, talk about all your eggs in one basket. But she has two obelisks end to end, and she shows the obelisk being towed by 23 boats. There's small boats attached to it, and it's going down the Nile.
You know, just as awe-inspiring as the thing itself is the idea that this thing – I can only imagine the spectators watching that happen. That would have been a day. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you know, it would be bumper-to-bumper traffic to see that kind of a thing happening.
Yeah, I bet people line the Nile, like you suggest, watching Queen Hatshepsut's obelisk come down the Nile. You know, really impressive. But, you know, there was something similar that I've thought about. You know, New York has an obelisk. The three obelisks that left in the 19th century were Paris, London, and New York in that order. Well, New York got its obelisk in 1881, and it came off the Hudson River, and the obelisk was brought through the city streets of New York. And imagine if you were a kid in 1881 and it's coming down your block. I mean, that must have been really incredible. You never forget that.
Yeah, it's surreal, because obelisks with hieroglyphs on them, that doesn't belong in a place like the New World, really.
Yeah, no. It must have been great on the west side of New York or something like that. It's just really cool.
Now, there are let's come to modern days and talk about these three needles, these Cleopatra's needles. You say London, Paris, New York. They are gifts. These happen in the 1800s. The earliest one in the early you say 1831-ish or so.
Yeah, 32-ish. Yeah, you're about right.
And then 1880s for the New York City. That's a long stretch of time. Is this kind of like getting a trophy or something?
Well, it is a little bit, in the sense that once the French got their obelisk in the 1830s, the other major cities just had obelisk envy, and they had to have one. But like you say, it took a while for them to get theirs after Paris got theirs, because it was so hard doing it. Everybody was afraid to try to pick it up. You know, Muhammad Ali had given them the obelisk, but they had to come and get it, and everybody was afraid to do it. And even when the French did it, they wanted an obelisk, but they just didn't have the guts to pick it up.
When it finally does move, though, tell us the story about when the Nile goes low, the seasonal, and then it has to be in its high flood stage to be able to even navigate the river, and that complicated the transport.
Yeah, the French took about 3 years to move their obelisk. It took them 3 years from the time they show up in Egypt to the time they erect it on the Place de la Concorde in Paris. And one of the reasons was that they had a special ship built that the obelisk would fit in that could navigate the Nile, because it's only a river. It's, you know, they're going down a river. So it's a special boat that's got called the Luxor. And they get the obelisk, you know, in the boat, but they've got to wait for a high Nile so it'll float off the bank of the Nile. And they're waiting months, you know, so they went on a tour of Egypt, you know, and they're waiting for the Nile to rise, and it didn't. And, you know, some years the Nile doesn't rise high enough, and they were a little worried. It was getting close, and the thing wasn't high enough, but finally the Luxor, the ship, floated up, and they went up the Nile. So, you know, they had to wait and wait for the Nile and navigate and wait for weather. You know, you couldn't set it off on the Atlantic, you know, for example, or whatever, because bad weather. So it took months and months and months of waiting before they could get it on the ocean.
What's the story about burying the boat, though, under desert sand?
Oh, you know, when the French came with their boat, they decided to ground the boat. They would sail the boat right into the bank at right angles, so that they could get the obelisk on it easily. They wouldn't have to maneuver it too much. So they ground their boat on the bank of the Nile. They get the obelisk in, right? And then they're going to wait 6 months or so for the Nile to rise. But they're afraid that the sun is going to crack the planks on the boat, because it's summer, it's hot as hell, you know, and they're afraid. So they buried it in sand, and they put mats on it, reed mats, and they watered their boat. They had the locals come and water it every day, pour Nile water on it, so that it would keep it wet so the wood wouldn't crack. You know, there was all kinds of problems they had with their obelisk, the French. You know, it wasn't easy. Nobody had an easy time bringing an obelisk back.
Now, these three that you mentioned, are they the only three obelisks to have left Egypt, or have other countries elsewhere gotten their hands on some?
Well, it's in modern times, since the 19th century, that they're the only ones. But you have Rome, which has 13 obelisks. But Rome's obelisks were brought over as trophies of war. The Romans had conquered Egypt, and the emperors were bringing back these obelisks as trophies.
So those in Rome are not facsimiles. They're not knockoffs.
No, they're the real deal. They're the real deal.
And so in ancient times, they were taking barges and boats down to the Nile and going across the Mediterranean?
Yeah, exactly. And as a matter of fact, you know, Caligula brought one. And the boat that brought it was specially built. The barge was specially built to bring it. And they thought it was such a great accomplishment that the barge was on exhibit for years, you know, just as a kind of thing of wonder. Yeah, no, the Romans brought them over, and, you know, pretty impressive. So when you walk through Rome, those are the real deal.
Bob, I'm fascinated by the tale of transporting one of these in basically a cylindrical sleeve of iron on a boat or dragged behind the boat.
Yeah, it was towed. It's the London Obelisk. And when they went to pick up their obelisk, their plan, and this is 1878, London is getting their obelisk. And their plan is to build what they called a caisson out of iron. It looks like a kind of the cigar tubes that fancy cigars come in. And so they build this big caisson, and they put their obelisk in it, and the caisson is going to be towed by a steamship. And this is the one that really ended in tragedy. So they've got the obelisk in their caisson, and they're going to sail it across to England, and the steamship is towing it. And on this caisson, there is a crew of three guys. They are inside the caisson. There's a way they can get out. There's a hatch they can get up. And they're communicating with the steamship by big chalkboard, like, that says, you can go faster or slow down. And they're communicating. But then they hit a hurricane. They were in the ocean at the Bay of Biscay, and they hit a hurricane. And it looked like the obelisk was going to sink. So they had to cut it free, but first they had to get the guys off the caisson, the three men who were on the caisson. So five brave men on the steamship volunteered to be lowered in a rowboat in a hurricane and row themselves over to the caisson to get these guys off. And as they're nearing the caisson, a huge wave comes, crashes down on the rowboat, and these five guys died. They were never seen again. So now you've lost five guys, you've still got the caisson, which looks like it's going to sink, and you've got three guys on that. Finally, the steamer gets around and throws a rope to the caisson and pulls the guys on board, and then they cut the caisson free. And the next day, after the hurricane subsided, they went back to see if they could find the caisson, and it was gone. The obelisk had sunk, they were pretty sure. They were wrong, fortunately. The obelisk was just sort of floating somewhere, and the next day, a steamship came along, saw it, knew what it was. Everybody was reading the newspaper accounts of London getting their obelisk, and they claimed it as salvage by the laws of the sea. They now owned the obelisk.
So slow down just a bit. The laws of the sea, what are you talking about there?
Well, salvage. If you find something on the sea that's been abandoned, it's yours.
Well, looky here. We just found us an obelisk.
Exactly, exactly. So they've got this obelisk, and they tow it to safety. They get a line on it. They tow it to a port, and they own the obelisk. So now the Brits have to negotiate, or actually the insurance company, has to negotiate to buy this obelisk from them. And there's this court case, which is a lot of fun, because the Brits say, you know, the court is going to decide what the obelisk is worth, and therefore what the Brits are going to have to pay for it. And the Brits are claiming, well, it's just a piece of stone. Let's figure out how much the granite costs. And the people who found the obelisk are saying, well, I think most of the capitals of Europe would pay quite a bit for an obelisk. So finally, they had to pay £3,000 sterling in 1878 to get their obelisk back. But that's how they got their London obelisk.
So when this finally arrives in London, it doesn't immediately go to its final destination, does it?
No, you know, Marcus, that is one of the things that always puzzles me about these smart guys who are moving obelisks and plan so well. All three obelisks, the Paris, the London, the New York, when they were towing their obelisks back to their cities, they still hadn't decided where it was going to go. I mean, why wait that long? So the London obelisk, when they get it to London, they don't know where it's going to go. Nobody knows where to put it. So they build a model obelisk, the same size as the obelisk, 87 feet high, out of wood. And they're dragging it through the streets of London, erecting it in various places. You know, like, what do you think about here, Harry? What do you think about here? You know, and they're bringing it around. So finally, they put it on the Thames by the river, because that's really where it belongs, because that's where it was. You know, it was in Alexandria, and it was by the Nile. So they thought it should go there.
Well, I want to hear from you a little bit about the kind of the physics of how these things stay up. I mean, are they pinned to the ground in some fashion?
That's another thing that I think is really remarkable. The obelisks are so precisely made that when the Egyptians put them on their pedestals, nothing is keeping them there except balance. They are just balanced so perfectly that they just stay upright. So there's no bronze fittings holding it. There's no pins, nothing like it.
Well,
that's
another distinct difference from, say, the Washington Monument, I would imagine. We're not just
Well, the Washington Monument is really a building. I mean, it's a structure in the shape of an obelisk. You know, it's made out of stones. You can go inside it. It's got rooms, you know. So that's really a building that's obelisk-shaped. So it's really quite different.
Yeah. Does it make you a little queasy, a little bit nervous to think of an obelisk just balanced there for a few centuries and not falling over until maybe you walk by?
No, I have a lot of faith in the ancient Egyptians.
They knew their engineering. My goodness.
Oh, they were amazing. That's why I say to me, sometimes the obelisks are the most amazing things, really.
Well, this is just terrific to hear from you. Do you have any feelings, though, about them being in the wrong place in these three cities far, far from where they originated? It just seems, you know, there's all this controversy about what do they call them, the Elgin marbles?
Marbles. Yes, I do have. I have only about one obelisk of the three. You see, I'm one of the few Egyptologists. I'm not one of the few. There are many that agree with me. I think it's okay to have Egyptian objects outside of Egypt. People learn about Egypt that way. They get to see things. Egypt certainly has plenty of ancient antiquities still left. So it doesn't bother me that antiquities are outside of Egypt. The one object I would like returned to Egypt is the Luxor obelisk, it's called, the one that went to Paris. And the reason is, there were two obelisks in front of Luxor Temple. They always came in pairs, two identical obelisks, and the French took one. The other one is still there at Luxor. Now, if we return the Paris one, you could have the two obelisks as they were 3,000 years ago in front of a temple, and I just think that would be spectacular because there's no Egyptian temple that has both its obelisks. So it would be just great if we could get the Paris one back to Luxor, but that's not going to happen.
Well, basically, anytime you're there, and I'm sure you've been there, every time you look at it, it seems a little lopsided to you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it looks that way to me.
Part of a conversation I had with Bob Breyer all about obelisks. He's a senior research fellow at Long Island University and author of Cleopatra's Needles, The Lost Obelisks of Egypt. Maybe one of the reasons somebody felt compelled to bring an obelisk from the old world to New York City is that our country is young enough that immense ancient monuments are a bit more rare around here. And it's interesting to reflect on how the absence of man-made monuments has let natural monuments fill in the gap. Here are a few thoughts on the matter from Eleanor Harvey, a previous guest on our show.
I really set out to try to understand how the United States became a culture obsessed with nature. We've known that the Hudson River School was our leading form of American art, that landscape was tasked with carrying our cultural ambitions, that we were, you know, sort of posited as a new Eden, that westward the course of empire made its way, and that the landscape was like symbolic of the scale and scope of our ambitions. But in part, we choose nature to define us because architecturally we are so many centuries behind the seven wonders of the world, all of which were man-made architectural monuments. And it is Humboldt who convinces Thomas Jefferson when he visits here in the United States in 1804, play to your strengths. Everything west of the Appalachian mountain chain is going to be new to science. Wow us with what's already here, not with what you hope to build on it. And as a result, from Lewis and Clark, through the Long Expedition, through Fremont's expeditions, through the great post-Civil War surveys, we are adding and cataloging natural features that become the backbone of the national park system, which is, in effect, America's set of monuments.
Eleanor Harvey is a senior curator at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. There is a phenomenal science educator in England, his name Jim Al-Khalili, and he may be the very best voice around today who can walk us through the high stakes of theoretical physics. I mean to say he can actually explain what quantum theorists and string theorists are doing. He may even own a Higgs boson particle. We're going to visit with him tomorrow. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.